Yeah, we stopped briefly to turn the tape over, and Miss Garrington, you were telling us about how your husband would have been a surgeon had his daddy not died.
Mm-hmm. See, kidney trouble ran in the Garrington side of the family. They all died around 50 or 60 years of age, several of them. It seemed to be a hereditary type of thing, and I told all of our daughters about it when they were going to have children. Of course, one girl couldn't have any children. She'd had to be sterilized. And so, now, do you want me to talk about that?
Yeah, tell us about Dr. Connell Garrington's graduation.
Oh, yeah. The dean of the medical school, University of Pennsylvania, at graduation opened his speech with, "Ladies and gentlemen, everything you have learned, with the exception of anatomy, is now out of date." And I can just imagine, they were shocked. And then he briefly explained something about the sulfa drugs, the antibiotics, newer surgical techniques, several different kind of instruments that were coming out that would aid in so many things that they had to do. And new studies, that was the birth of psychiatry and psychology. At first it was not required, and then soon it began to be.
As a field of study in medical school.
Medical school, mm-hmm. But some things that we lost began losing it with the development over the years of study and such, were home visits. And when people began to buy automobiles and our roads began developing better, it was better to come into the hospital or to the doctor's office, and he could do a much better service for you.
Where he had his instruments.
Where he had everything. And truck lines began coming in here. Planes began to develop. Railroads. There were no such thing as a plane when I first came.
Sure.
And just,
when Connell practiced medicine in the office behind the house there, he had to go out to deliver babies, didn't he?
Yes.
And how was he contacted at that point?
Well, they would come in on a mule and cart. We did have telephones then. And they would go, if they didn't have one, they knew a neighbor that would help them do it. Or if they couldn't get in, maybe a husband was the only one there with his wife, he'd go tell a neighbor. The neighbor would come in and tell that Mrs. So-and-so is that way and needs the doctor.
That way.
And so, and I didn't know what they were talking about right at first. He said, "My wife's that way." And when I went and told Carl one day, and I said, "What is it when a woman's that way?" He said, "She's going to have a baby."
You know. Was this before your first child was born?
Yes. And income was increasing around here. They began raising something beside tobacco. They raise some Irish potatoes, and there was a cucumber season for a while. And then when they found out that they could begin to raise other things, they called them soja beans, but they were soybeans, really. And they found it was even, they had markets abroad where they could sell them, because they're a wonderful source of protein and such.
When do you think that happened, the diversification in the farming back then?
Now that I don't know. I mean, I think you might have to go to the agricultural department.
For that one. Yeah. But you saw it happening while you were there.
I did. And I saw better schooling coming in. And I think part of that was due to television and radio, plus the fact with the better income, they were able to send their children to universities. or colleges. And
your kids grew up and went to public school there in Bethel, I guess.
Yes, and before mine ever finished going to school there, every teacher we had had her master's. He or she had their master's degrees.
How wonderful.
And they went from a group that would brag about, I made it without so much schooling, you know, to one that saw, I missed a whole lot too.
You know, I just remembered, Cecil Garrington, among our papers, is a teacher's certificate for first grade. Did you know that about him? Connell's daddy had a first grade teacher certificate.
Is that right?
So not only could he catch fish for a living and practice medicine, he could have taught first grade.
Oh my land, he made a good one too.
Yeah.
But these are some things that I saw, and some changes in the position of women in medicine too. Mm-hmm. More of them began going to school and to med school. But another interesting little thing was the advent of these various sprays that would kill insects that farmers had to fight all the time.
Sure.
And one that's more or less outlawed today is DDT. And Colm got some of that. And going out to some of these houses where you had to deliver babies, I was always scared to death, and so was his mother, about her husband bringing bed bugs home. And they made it a point never to sit down in an upholstered chair. It was a wooden chair. But he was delivering a woman, waiting for her to, you know, deliver the baby one night. And he noticed when he'd pull the sheet back, there would be a train of little black bugs going across. So he got this can of DDT out and sprayed it. And called to her husband and said, look. He said, Doc, you is magic. He called the neighbors.
See the insects then.
Yeah. And they wanted to know where you got that stuff and what they thought, you know, what can they use it on their crops and such. And
that's a remarkable story.
And then I think one thing I think women the world over, although it's not accepted the world over, we're glad that the sex of the child is dependent upon the husband and not her. And but some of them, they just won't be. But you know, have you ever noticed that maybe we broach and start talking about a change that will affect probably all of us? And it's just introduced. It's not broadened or anything, but quietly behind the scenes it is. And then 20 years later, they bring it out, and they don't have much trouble getting people to accept it. It takes a long time for a new idea to develop.
That's true.
And then there was no such thing as Medicare or Medicaid. Or Blue Cross was around for a long time, but we didn't have much of anything else to help us out.
The health insurance. I understand that many patients paid for their medical care with food.
Food. It was a long time before I could get Colm Garrington to eat a piece of cold cake. See, over the weekends, maybe they get 4 or 5 cakes. But and you couldn't say anything. The people were trying. And pies and cakes. And I remember one dear little black woman. This was after Colm's dad had died. But she said, I knew that we owed this doctor bill. It was a Sunday. And she rang the back doorbell. Mother Bell went and answered it. Mother Bell knew who she was. And she had a tiny little ham. Dried up, you could have used it for a brick. But she gave it to Mother Bell, and she said, this is the last one I have. And Mother Bell looked at her, she said, it was one cold, rainy Sunday. And she said, I couldn't help it. I went to the closet and got out a nice, heavy, warm sweater and gave it to that woman because she didn't have anything warm enough on. Mother Bell was constantly helping somebody. And so I would do what I could, but they didn't need as much when I came as they had needed so many times before. Plus the fact I hadn't been in it that long to even notice a whole lot of it.
And I bet you felt better, though, when the new clinic was built.
Yeah.
And Connell didn't have to go to deliver babies. They
That's
could come
right.
to him.
Come to him.
Yeah.
And you know, we were having these tornadoes around here there for just the last week or so. I remember one night, it wasn't a tornado. We were having a hurricane that day. And they called Connell to come look after this girl. She's not but 13 years old, and Doc, she's that way. And so we got her in the house, and we got her tied down. As Connell went out there, and they had pushed two ladder back chairs together, you know, to make some kind of a cot and had a pillow under her head. But they had all left her when they thought he would arrive there, and then he could sit and wait until she delivered the baby. He said, I felt so sorry for that child, he said, but they didn't want her messing up the bed.
Well, do you mind, could we turn to the personal side of your life? As the wife of Dr. Garrington, you had mentioned that he told you right at the beginning of your relationship that medicine would come first.
Mm-hmm.
How was that for you?
Frankly, it didn't sink in right at first. I just, I hadn't experienced anything like this. And but the more I thought about it, when the first thing came up, he just looked at me and I said, go ahead. And gradually after that, I started, I had to explain it to the children that Daddy had to go. And of course, once in a while you can be disappointed, but it wasn't that hard, really. And I had always been able to entertain myself with something. And and he made up so many times later and took me places, been to England and all over Europe, went to England 3 times.
Marvelous.
And I went and took some classes at the Royal School of Needlework. And
what a treat.
Yeah. And and then we went all to England, France, Germany, Italy. Italy was the country I thought was so sorry for. During the war, they had a time that was awful.
Did. Yeah.
And he was so interesting to be around. That's constantly learning. He would be surprised when I came up with an idea. I didn't have any idea you could think like that. You rascal. He was teasing me. Yeah. So.
Teasing you. When he took the time to listen,
yeah.
You had a head on your shoulder. I understand that he was interested in all sorts of things, constantly.
Constantly. In fact, there was a... There was only one electrician in Bethel when they first put electricity in the town, you know, all over. Joe, I can't think of his last name. He called my husband the pest.
The pest?
Because Carl followed him around. He wanted to know what he was doing and why he was doing it. And that curiosity never left him. They're interesting people like that. There's somebody that just, oh, don't bother me about that, you know, their attitude is.
I understand that he liked gadgets. Connie wrote that he had a Minox spy camera?
Mm-hmm.
And what else did she say? A calculator, a miniature calculator, and some other things, she said, in a drawer.
Mm-hmm. Everything like that came out, he had to find out how it worked, and if possible, he bought one. And I told him one time when he was wanted me to have every kind of a gadget in the kitchen, I said, Carla, there's coming a time when these children are all going to be gone, and he always had help for me. That came about. I bleed under the skin very easily. And when my first two girls were 3 and 4 years old, no, maybe not that old, maybe 2 and 3, that's when little girls wore sunsuits with ruffles on the bottom, and I ironed ruffles. 32 sunsuits I ironed that day, and when I got up, my arms were black and blue up to here. He said, you don't do any more ironing. So he got me a black woman. She could iron beautifully. And we had a lot of them. We'd work bills out that way and helped out. And he took a very good care of me. Yeah.
There's a cabinet behind you on the wall that has a trumpet in it and a ukulele. It's a beautiful glass-fronted cabinet with red velvet behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Tell me about those instruments.
Well, he played the trumpet. I knew 6 years through Wake Forest he went to pre-med and 2 years of medical school through Wake Forest. And he played it in high school in Bethel. So practically all his life, is when he got big enough to blow, his father bought him this very nice trumpet. And he could always play a ukulele, and there's a flute in there, and the ocarina.
Oh, it's a little piccolo.
Yeah, a little piccolo.
It's a wooden, it's not a piccolo, it's a wooden flute, a little black wooden
mm-hmm,
flute.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, very special one.
And he could always do something like that.
Did he sing as well?
He could, but he had a terrible voice.
Did he?
I was one that could sing. Uh-huh. And if I couldn't get it in the choir, if I couldn't get the... I'm not a first soprano. I'm a mezzo.
Sure.
And so lots of times to fit in, I'd have to read it. And it was hard for me to get. He'd just reach over and sing it in my ear. That's the way we'd get it. But he'd do everybody, the bass, the tenor, every bit of it. Was just
he could hum the melody line, read the melody line,
mm-hmm.
but his projection, he couldn't really make the sounds himself, but he could hand it over to somebody
yeah.
else.
Mm-hmm.
Isn't that wonderful?
And he could do it. He lays that to the fact that they used to have clinics or days when all the children who needed their tonsils out, they'd set it all up, and all these kids would bring them, and the doctors and nurses would do this wholesale, you might say.
In Bethel. They had their tonsil days.
The tonsil day. Mm-hmm. And they said that they just did too much to him. His mother said Carl had a fairly good voice till they got through with him.
Oh, I see. He was the patient.
He was the patient.
He
wanted the children this time, not the doctor doing the work. Although they did do some of those after I came even.
I understand another thing he got to do was sew people up after fights at the clinic.
You know, Saturday night would come, and I'd almost hate to see it, because they got into more fights. And at that time, the main instrument they would use would be an ice pick.
Oh.
A lot of those had to go to the hospital because it's just a little tiny mark on the outside, but they're bleeding underneath.
Puncture wound.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And the ones he sewed up were done with a razor. They used to carry razors somewhere on their body and use these. And they would get drunk and somebody'd say something and start something going.
Out came the blades.
And we had a few gunshot wounds. And but we didn't have the problem with drugs. We had some drug addicts. and they would come through, and if they knew the doctor had his license to dispense drugs, then they would try to make up stories, you know, that they had lost their prescription and such as this. Well, the FBI had notified the local druggist and the doctors in town. It wasn't that widespread the way it is today. We could pretty well keep it under control, but every once in a while one got loose.
The FBI would notify the doctors and pharmacists of known abusers.
Mm-hmm. Of course, we had one or two that the government had given them permission to so they could combat the pain, whatever disease they had that was painful all the time. And this was the only thing that relieved it. Yeah. And those poor souls had to go into hiding almost because the addicts would get after them.
For their drugs, yeah, mm-hmm. Sure.
Somebody would let it leak, you know, from the government that they were on the permissive list. And already got out. Maybe some member of the family told it. Some other soul thought, And so.
Well, I know you've had a very interesting life and contributed a lot yourself to the health care there in Bethel.
Well, I've tried, and I think. Actually, I've been very, very blessed. When I hear some of the stories these poor people around here, you know, and look, you can't pick the paper up today, but what it isn't full of stuff going on. And I don't know how people combat a lot.
Connie said she wrote in her letter that she felt she'd had a really blissful childhood because you didn't ever have to lock the doors of your big house.
Oh, no, nobody
locked. The windows were open at night. If somebody came to the window, it was because they needed the doctor.
I remember one night waking up, and I heard somebody downstairs, and I went to the head of the stairway, and I said, "Who's that down there?" I said, "It's Cheyenne Rollins, Miss Garrington." He was one of the village idiots, you know, we used to. I said, "Cheyenne, what are you doing in Dr. Garrington's house?" He said, "Well, I ain't never been in here, and I'm just looking around. I ain't going to do nothing."
Middle of the night.
I put on my bathrobe and just sat up at the top of the stair steps. I didn't know whether, you know, he might slip a little
sure.
bit sometime. And,
or hurt himself, or
yeah.
Who knows what could have happened.
And so I just eventually went to the telephone upstairs and I called Walter Gray. His son is Bradley Gray, the realtor who sold our house in Bethel for me. And told him what was going on. He said, "I'll get him, Miss Garrington. He does this all the time."
You helped each other out a lot, didn't you?
Yeah.
In that little town.
And people would do that. And if you needed something and you didn't have enough, you needed an onion, you know, you knew where you could go get it, or another egg or something. And it's just wonderful. Loan one another clothes. I remember when one woman was going off to a meeting, she came and asked me if she could use my stole, mink stole that I had at that time. Why I ever bought that thing's too hot for anything like that around here.
Yeah.
So, but everybody had one, and so Carl bought me one.
He was a remarkable person, I know.
He really and truly was.
Took good care of his family and the people in the community, too.
That's right. And we took good care of him as far as we could.
Yes, you could.
Mm-hmm.
When did he have a stroke? In the early 80s?
Was
that?
He died in 85. Mm-hmm. And the last 5 years were kind of bad. Dr. Fleming and Dr. Shuping over here took care of him most of the time, and I'd bring him over.
He had closed the clinic down in, wasn't it 75? Sort of the Bethel clinic was not really, it didn't have so many doctors. And he sent the patients to the maternity patients to the hospital here in Greenville after that time, didn't he? Is that what?
Well, both Dr. Jordan and Dr. Moody, Dr. Jordan came over here and Dr. Tucker examined him with his ulcers and everything, mm-hmm. and told him he had to give up general practice. He said, people don't realize that general practice is very stressful. You're constantly changing.
Sure.
And Dan just didn't adapt very well. And you don't really know what it's about till you actually get out and have to do it.
Surely.
And Dr. Moody, he himself resigned because he said, I find that I'm trying awfully hard to stay away from morphine, but I slip a dose every once in a while, and I'm liable to make a serious mistake. Mm-hmm. So he signed himself. The letters were there at the house, and I kept them. And he went to Butner, where they take care of a lot of people like that. And so, of course, they kept everything. He admitted what he was doing. Mm-hmm. And I love Bill Moody. He's a really good fellow. And I love Dan, too. But Dan would get mad at me because I wouldn't fall for him like the women in Bethel did.
Well, you had your man.
I said, I've got a perfectly good man. You go get your own girl. And in fact, he had one, and her sister is here now, Malene Irons.
Yes.
She and Fred have both come into Cypress Glen in the last week or so.
I'm going to visit with them soon.
You are?
But tell me this, between Malene and Dan Jordan, Malene's sister?
It was Malene's sister, Ruth, I think, Grant was her name. That was their name, you know, before they got married. And but her sister would not marry Dan because she got tuberculosis.
Oh, bless her heart.
And she said that isn't right to marry somebody and saddle them with that. And Dan had always wanted children, and she said, I can't give you any children. So it broke his heart.
Story? Oh, yes.
And hers, too.
Malene. They were acting very responsibly, though.
Yes, I think so.
And it was something else in the old days that
mm-hmm.
people took care of.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So she, and he told me, he said, well, you married Carl after he had tuberculosis. I said, Dan, it was a different type. And I said,
besides, he didn't have to bear the babies.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. It makes a difference.
It made a difference.
Yeah.
And so.
Well, but, so Dr. Garrington practiced by himself then in the clinic?
For quite a while, yes.
Yeah.
And after they both left, he was just there by himself. But this medical school and everything was just growing by leaps and bounds. Mm-hmm. And so a good bit of it was being taken care of
That's
elsewhere.
Good. It came just in time for him,
just,
didn't it?
Just for him, and it all worked out all right. And then toward the very last, he had no idea who anybody was. He would look at me, and I knew. I said, Carl, this is Hilda. Just like that.
Good to see you.
And he'd go to bed completely dressed, and I'd have to go up there and undress him, and take a shower in the bathroom, and wouldn't pull the curtain or shut the door. Water everywhere. And I just couldn't fuss. I thought to myself, there's my life going down the tube.
Well, it was a mighty good one, I know, though.
Mm-hmm.
You had a special man.
Uh-huh. I wish my kids could have all had him. My oldest girl, Connie's got a good fella. She broke him in, right, I think. He came from a family, the Hackneys. We're in the Hackney bodybuilding. You see the Coca-Cola truck with Hackney body on the back. That's who that family
was. Connie's husband.
Mm-hmm.
Would you like me to stop the tape now? I think we've had a wonderful interview.
Yeah. All right.
Thank
I wish you
so
would.
Much.
Well, you're welcome. I hope you got what you wanted.
You gave us all sorts of wonderful information. Thank you.
Well, you're welcome.